Can everybody hear okay? Excellent. Okay, like to welcome you to the MSU Library. I'm Mike Unsworth, the Canadian Studies and American History Bibliographer here. And I would like to introduce our speaker, Dr. Wilma King. As most of you know, she's a professor in the Department of History here at MSU. And as a graduate from Bloomington, I'm very glad to see that she received her doctorate from Indiana University. She has written and edited several books on African American history. Her most recent effort is Stolen Childhood, Slave Youth in 19th Century America, published by the Indiana University Press. And today she will be discussing her forthcoming book, The Essence of Liberty, Free African American Women Before Emancipation in the United States. Please welcome Dr. King.
Very much. And I am also wanting to say that I am pleased to have received the invitation from Mr. Peter Berg here at the library, who invited me initially to talk about my forthcoming work. And someone just asked me a few minutes ago, how long would this be? When you invite people to talk about their forthcoming work, you know, it could go on and on and on, but I won't do that for you this afternoon. And I did not realize that you too were a graduate of Indiana University. Yeah. Okay, very good. Indiana University's colors are red and white, in case you didn't know. Now, the title of this paper is called The Essence of Freedom, Essence of Liberty, and it's about free African-American women before emancipation in the United States. And the presentation is based upon a larger work, which I hope will be by the same title. Publishers have a way of changing the titles of your books so that they can market them, but I do think that The Essence of Liberty will say it all, in the sense that Essence is the name of a magazine that is edited for and that is edited by African American women, and it is known as the African American Woman's Magazine. Not only that, when we talk about freedom, you have to ask a question. What was freedom? Was it an elusive spirit of independence, or was it fleeting? Did these women have a sense of autonomy, or was it an extract of something that made up their self-sufficiency? Or was the essence of liberty, you know, the very pith, the very core of a thing? And I think when you talk about the essence, it can be in your hands or it can be in the air. And sometimes the essence of liberty was actually more symbolic than real. So I do hope that the title of the book, whenever it does appear, will be The Essence of Liberty. And when we look at The Essence of Liberty, you can find this by looking at the relationships that women held with on a one-to-one basis with other free women. And then look at the relationships that these women had with other people without regard for color, class, gender, and region. And when you talk about the essence of liberty, you're looking at how these women worked, how they reared their children and enjoyed their leisure. They fought for rights to improve their lives and to improve the lives of others. Now, today's presentation focuses on the state of the research on the subject, along with some remarks about the lives of free women and their place in society and how they were perceived by others. When you look at the African American population, it's clear that you had less than a million Africans who were transported into English-speaking North America by the time the overseas slave trade ended. And you had a disproportionate number of women who came in that number, so you had some disparities, of course, in the sex ratio. You had, almost from the beginning, people who were free, and then you'd have some people who were enslaved. So slavery and freedom actually goes hand in hand in many ways. Now, by the time the first census was taken in 1790, there were 757,181 persons of African descent in the United States. And of that number, 59,000 were free. Now, I don't know how many of that initial number were women because they did not break it out by whether it was male or female at that time. But by 1860, the total African American population in this country was 4.3 million. And the number of free persons in the country had risen to 434,000. And at least 253,000 of those individuals were females of all ages. So you have about an equal number, well, little more than an equal 50% of the free people who were female in 1860. And of this number, the free women lived in the North as well as the South. And at one time, we had been thinking that the greater number of free people lived in urban areas. But more recent studies suggest that they are in the countryside right along with being in the urban areas. So you have a population that's spread from the North to the South, and you have them in rural as well as urban areas. And the growth of the free population from colonial days to the mid-19th century resulted from a number of reasons. First, you had children who were born to free women, black as well as white. Then there were public as well as private manumissions. There were legal actions, self-purchases, as well as runaways. Additionally, when Louisiana was purchased by the United States, with this territory came people, and many of whom were free people of color. Now, despite the presence of free people in the country in significant numbers, your prevailing interest have been in the slave population. In fact, once Frederick Douglass made a speech, and Frederick Douglass talked about women. He said, "We hear about the inadequate wages paid to women and the deficit representation of women in public life. We hear about the wrongs that are perpetrated against them and excluding them from the pursuits of the most lucrative branches of trade. We admit it all, we lament it all, and yet we may ask, what are all these wrongs compared to the ghastly wrongs that are perpetrated upon the defenseless slave woman?" Now, Frederick Douglass would continue in that line of speaking, and I think he was answering some comments that had to do with white women asking for particular kinds of rights. But we have to be clear in knowing that there were many free black women who had similar concerns as white women of the time. Now, Frederick Douglass continued in that same vein, and in doing so, he spoke specifically to free black women. And he said, "Other women suffer wrongs, but the wrongs peculiar to women out of slavery, great and terrible as they are endured as well by the slave woman, who has also had to bear 10,000 wrongs of slavery. It is harder, it is hard to be underpaid for labor faithfully performed," he said, "but it is harder still not to be paid at all." And he goes on down and he talks about the problems that women face, but then he says that these problems are real to be sure, but the problems of slave women are greater. Now, whether Frederick Douglass intended to or not, in my opinion, he did marginalize the condition of free African American women. And about 100 years, more than 100 years after Douglass spoke, there was a monograph published on free black women in the black women in the 19th century. And that book is "Aren't I a Woman? Slave Women in the Plantation South." And then we go on from there, and you see large numbers of books that have been published about slave women. Kent Anderson's book is one of the more recent ones about slave women. And then Jacqueline Jones, some time ago in the 1980s, published a book called "Labor of Love, Labor of Sorrow." And it begins with the very important chapter, "My Mother Was Much a Woman, Women's Work and Slavery." Well, I am arguing that there were many free women who were just as much of a woman as a slave woman, and it's now time to take a look at these free women across geographical regions as well as across classes. And we're at that juncture where I think it's important that we go beyond a book like Adele Alexander's Ambiguous Lives. It is a very fine book, but it is a book that is limited because it deals with women who are in middle Georgia, and many of these women are interconnected by families. And then Virginia Gould has written a dissertation on free women of color in New Orleans, Mobile, and Pensacola, and she does much to eradicate the void about free women in the Gulf regions. But then what about the women who did not live in middle Georgia, who did not live in the cities of New Orleans, Pensacola, or Mobile? There is a new dissertation, which I just bought, but I have not read it. It's called Till Fair Aurora Rises, and this is about African American women in Memphis, Tennessee. So what I am suggesting here is that there are a number of studies that are coming out, but some of them are narrowly focused. They may look at maybe three counties, as is the case with Victoria Bynum's book, Unruly Women. Looks at three counties in North Carolina. Till Fair Aurora Rises looks at Memphis, Tennessee. So it's very clear to me that the scholars have made some contributions, but I am suggesting that it is time for us to go further than that and do a larger kind of study so that we can answer questions outside of those port cities and outside of a city like Memphis and other places. And answer questions, and some of these questions are questions that rise as a result of some of the things that free women said. For example, in 1836, Maria Stuart lamented about the condition of free blacks, and she said, "With few exceptions, the life of free blacks is little better than that of their enslaved contemporaries." Stuart admitted the possibility of being erroneous in making her statement. Certainly there were some differences between the essence of liberty for those people who were free and what was happening to those persons who were enslaved. There were the legal differences. Free men and women, unlike chattel, they owned their own person. They could own real estate. They could own personal property. They could sue. They could be sued. They could marry legally, and they could divorce. Differences in legal statuses between enslaved and emancipated women were clear, yet you have very, very few free persons, whether they were male or female, who would escape race-based discrimination. The essence of liberty. Free women before emancipation attempts to bring together a large body of literature by and about free women in order to answer some questions. What did it really mean to be free in a slave society? What did it mean to be a free woman in a slave society? Beyond that, the essence of liberty attempts to answer questions focusing on the free women's economic pursuits. You know, how did they make a living? How did their work differ from the work of slave women? What were their cultural activities? How did they respond to gender conventions? And what were their roles in the overthrow of slavery? Did these things differ according to geographical regions? And I'm confident that I'll find the answers. And the answers are sometimes buried in many materials like your public accounts, as well as in your published records. And then you have those highly visible women like Charlotte Fort and Mary Ann Shadd. I think there are at least 10 to 15 autobiographical accounts that were written by free African American women in the 19th century. And then there are the manuscripts. Recently, some of you might have seen an essay that was in Gender and History. It was called No Kisses Is Like Yours, and it's about a lesbian relationship between two African-American women in Connecticut in the 19th century. And this is new, this is fresh, in the sense that people have often talked about the relationships between women. But this is the first time, I think, that there has been a publication to this extent that takes it to another level. In learning that the letters, there were 171 letters written between these two free African-American women in Connecticut, and learning that those letters had been microfilmed, I purchased them to see what I could tease out of the collection that was different from what had already appeared in Gender and History. There must be about 50 to 70 letters that deal with one of these women working in Virginia after the Civil War ends. So the same kinds of things that Charlotte Fortin talks about in working in South Carolina at the end of the Civil War, you find this in Virginia. And I think when people come to a body of letters or whatever with different kinds of questions, then you find different kinds of material. So the resources are there. And the resources will shed light on free women who lived in the countryside, who also lived in urban areas in your major cities like Philadelphia, New York, and Boston. Beyond that, beyond where they lived, the social context is important. For example, Boston was the home of William Lloyd Garrison's Liberator. And Boston was also a city where you had a large number of runaway slaves, male and female. Boston was also where Maria Stuart made her home. And unlike her slave sisters, Maria Stuart left a variety of documents that we can use. She wrote materials that can be used, and she, like Frances E.W. Harper, also would leave materials behind for us to use. And then when you move out of your major northern cities into places like New Orleans, Charleston, Savannah, Petersburg, you also have a significant amount of data available about women of color. I was very pleasantly surprised to read in a graduate student's paper, Ms. Nicole Rybianski did a paper on free women in Nashville, Tennessee, a couple of years ago, and she found that there were 257 women who were free in Nashville before the Civil War in 1850. 257 free women, and then by 1860, that number had increased to 420. And she looked at the kinds of things that they did in terms of how they made a living. They had cook shops, they had restaurants, they had boarding houses, and they advertised their businesses in the newspaper, and she was able to use that. So you can always ask the question again and again, what was life like for them? What was this essence of liberty for them? Was it real? Was it more? Was it real or was it symbolic? When you talk about the numbers of free women in this period, I urge that anyone who is doing such a study be very careful in relying heavily upon statistics, because there are any number of women who were virtually free, but they had not been emancipated, meaning that someone had bought them. They did not live as slaves, but they did not have the actual credentials to say that they were free. So they were free, yes, but they had not been emancipated. So there's always this danger of them being taken back. These are people who may be called quasi-slaves. You know, sometimes people talk about the quasi-free. These are people who are free, but then the lives are very much like the lives of slaves. But I'm looking at it from the obverse side. Here you have some people who are actually slaves, but they behave very much like free individuals. And then you also have some women, especially in the Gulf ports, and I suspect there's some men too. Some of these women of color in the Gulf cities of New Orleans, Pensacola, and Mobile, who are black but they pass for white. And then there are some who are slaves and they pass for free. I mean, how do you tell a slave when you see one? And you can't say it's because this person is black because this person is ragged. There are any number of free people who also were black and who were ragged. So and the whole deal about the social construction of race, I think works pretty much like this social construction, just in the eyesight of individuals like who is a slave. In the South, it was presumed that every black person was a slave. In the North, it was presumed that black people were free. Then what do you do with a group of people who call themselves Creoles? Gwendolyn Midloe Hall says that they defined themselves to mean racially mixed. Then they enforced this by marrying within their own groups. And then they distinguished themselves by looking down upon blacks. And some of what they did, it was based up on culture as well as up on color. And some of the more interesting research that I have done with this was to go to Natchitoches, Louisiana, where you have a large number of people who are Creoles. And I'm going to circulate something here. I have some photographs, and I was trying to save money. I thought I'd do my own. But then once I did this, I realized that I have to go to a professional photographer. And what I'm going to do is circulate this so that you can see there's a tremendous house here. And this tremendous house belonged to a free family of color. It's on the National Historic Register. Also, there are two houses on the side, and one of these houses is called the African House. And if you're familiar with Clementine Hunter, the folk painter, then she left a lot of her paintings in the Africa House, and the other house is the home of Marie Therese. On the back side, there is a church that this family founded. It's an active church as well as an active cemetery, and at the very bottom, there's a photograph of a nun who was from the Sisters of the Holy Family. And this was basically to say that so many of the free people of color in Louisiana are Catholic, and they have maintained that tradition. So please take a look at this, if you will. So I have to deal with the people who are Creole, and how they see themselves and how others see them. And when we talk about free people, did they interact liberally with others around them? What were the interactions between individuals who were enslaved? I think the answer always is in looking across geographical boundaries. For example, what free people experience in the Upper South is very different from what they experience in the Lower South in terms of the relationships with slave people. The historian Ira Berlin said, standing a step above the slave, these freedmen could see how their status might degenerate if they knew whites needed only the flimsiest excuse to grab their liberty. And they were not willing to surrender. This is the free people. They were not willing to surrender their benefits without a guarantee of something better. So the bottom line on what Ira Berlin is saying is that free people held themselves separate from slave people. And that is in the Upper South. And if you go into the Lower South, you'll see some examples of this same kind of thing happening in the Lower South, and you can pick out some particular groups of people, but we cannot say at this stage that that was true among all people in the Lower South or even Upper South, simply because we have a book, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. And Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl is an excellent book for looking at across generations and looking at the relationship between free women and enslaved women, because Harriet Jacobs is a slave when she runs away and she hides herself for 7 years in her grandmother's attic, who happens to be a freed woman. Her grandmother's a freed woman, she has her own freedom, but her grandmother also owns a slave, her own son. So this can be very complicated. But in any case, I think it depends upon individuals across geographical regions as to whether or not you have free women who did interact with those who were in slavery. In the North, it's a different matter. In the North, it's a very different matter. And once you go through the masses of data, it's still very important always to keep in mind the question that we started out with, and that question is, what was life really like for these free people, and what was the real essence of liberty for them? Society defined the role for women, and society also circumscribed their behavior. Women were to concern themselves with the duties of wife and mother. And your popular 19th century magazines touted purity, piety, submissiveness, and domesticity as those desired attributes of true womanhood. And you have many free black women who did indeed accept that cult of true womanhood. And I'm inclined to think that Sarah Mapp's Douglas Bunch of Flowers, which I'm going to put here on the overhead, has something to do with, is that right? Okay. When I first came to Michigan State, I didn't know how to use the overhead projector because I'd never worked in very, very large classes. And when I read my evaluations, one student said, things got better when Dr. King learned how to use the overhead. So I made some progress. Okay, when we look at this, what's on the overhead here, Sarah Mapps Douglas was a free woman. Here you have a bunch of flowers. And she put the, she painted these flowers in watercolor in a student's notebook. A notebook for them was like an autograph book. And any person that a student admired, they may take that notebook and ask, you know, to write something in it. So she painted the flowers. These she has this bunch of flowers, and then she wrote beneath that, and she's saying, "All species of the fuchsia drop their heads toward the ground in such a manner that their inner beauties can only be discerned when they are somewhat above the eye of the spectator. In a meaner flower, this might not attract attention, but most of the fuchsias are eminently beautiful both in form and color, and this modest bending of the head is the more remarked from the singular and peculiar beauty of the parts of the flower, which they seem anxious to conceal." And as I see it, here is a teacher who is drawing in a student's book, and she's giving the student a lesson. And the lesson is beautifully and significantly typifying modesty, which she added to the end. And here you have these flowers that are turned down. And she's saying to this young woman, it has something to do with behavior. It has something to do with behavior. And once she finished describing the flowers, she said, beautifully and significantly typifying modesty. I mean, do you say flowers are modest? So what's the message? I think some of this has to go with the deconstruction of what it is that this woman said and what it is that she did not say. So while we have these things on the overhead projector, what I want to do now is just take a bit of time and look at how free women were perceived by some people around them, and especially how they were perceived by individuals in Philadelphia. There was a whole series called Life in Philadelphia, which was a series of caricatures that really were commenting on the life of free people. And when I looked at the originals, I was very interested in how the women were portrayed. And these women were looked upon not necessarily as buying into the cult of true womanhood. This comes from the series. And if these women, and many of them were modest, as modest as their money would allow them, and they dressed in particular ways. And I don't think that one would have found a woman in, let's say, 1830, 1820, wearing a dress with such a shoulder on it like that. But then if you look at this dress, it is also saying something about how much money might have gone into this. This is a commentary on conspicuous consumption also. And I think if you were to really measure this woman's size, like the size of her feet, the size of her hands, they would be way out of proportion with the other parts of her body. Here again, it's also from the series, and it's looking at these free women. Again, she's dressed in a very fashionable way, and there is another one here where a woman goes out to buy some shoes. And this is from Life in Philadelphia. And again, it's a criticism of free people. It is also looking at conspicuous consumption. And in this caricature, it's called The New Shoes. And the woman here is selecting a pair of shoes, and she doesn't want black shoes because it is such a dirty color. David Claypool Johnston, as well as David Clay, were the persons who did the graphic racist caricatures. And there have been dissertations and books actually written on these. But since I'm working on women, with women, then I wanted to look specifically at how the women were treated. And here is another, again from the same series. And this is a lady. This is a lady, and she is readying herself. And here you see her looking in the mirror. Again, her chest is out. You can see it's clear that she has breasts. She also has her hair in a high style, but I think what's just very interesting here, you see the cat, and you don't see cats in photographs and drawings like this. This is the way they come out on October 31. You know, when there's a problem, they're scared, they're frightened. And it's like she's looking at herself here, and the cat also sees her. So the cat is frightened. And then you could take that a step further. There are some people who believe that these women were, they're involved in some other kinds of things, black magic or whatever. Now, again, what would it be like for a woman to see these? And these were very, very popular, and they were circulated about. Not only were they popular in the United States, they were popular in Europe. Again, if you were to look at the dimensions of this woman, you can see how her features are exaggerated. Look at her feet, and this is called the love letter. And it is poking fun at people who have resources, people who have educations, and it's poking fun at them as if they cannot pronounce the words. And in the text here, this woman is reading a letter from an admirer. And he is saying that he is so very impressed with her classic beauty. And since he met her, he could do nothing else other than to think of her like the blackest of villains. And then he signs his letter, "I remain your adorable lover, L-U-B-B-E-R," and his name is Augustus Octavio Whiteman. So these will play an important part in the book. I will have them in a chapter that deals with gender conventions and talking about how these women see themselves and how others saw them. And there was a lot of criticism about free women and free people in Philadelphia being involved in polite society. And here you have a dancing scene of individuals. But that one is not, probably is not the most poignant of them. Here you have a group of women, and they're supposed to be so ignorant they don't know their left foot from the right. So on the wall, the dance instructor has a set of rules. You put the pink ribbon on one foot, you put a blue ribbon on the other foot, and when he teaches them to dance, he calls it out by colors. It seems to me if you don't know your left from your right, you might not know pink from blue. I don't understand this part of it. But what is it? How did free women actually look? Here you have a woman. This is a woman who had taken her book, her autograph book, to Sarah Douglas. And here is Nancy Ruffin. Nancy Ruffin was a free woman who moved from somewhere like Richmond, Virginia, to go into the North so that their children would have a chance for an education. Okay, so there you have some images. And then I have to answer the question, what did these women do for a living? And there a variety of things. They didn't fit into the true cult of womanhood in the sense that they had to go out and work and they had to leave their families behind. And there are a lot of women who didn't fit simply because of economic reasons. But as far as the purity and the piety part, then I'm sure that there were many of the free women who actually were very much in favor. So you have free women who work outside the home at many occupations. They work as domestics, they work as peddlers, shopkeepers, teachers, they're laundresses, they're seamstresses, they're hairdressers. And not all of these women, some of these women lived in economic poverty, but then you have a lot of other women who did not suffer severely. And there are plenty of outstanding examples of free women who were quite well-heeled financially. Quite well-heeled financially. And I find that there is a connection between their resources and others. Resources, if they have monies, and especially in the South, in the lower South, if they have money, there's almost always, it's not always the case, but there's often a link between these women, their resources, and another person, and the other person is a white person, and that is a person who may be a member of the family, that may be a person who they share no blood relationship with. So you have those linkages. There are some others where it doesn't necessarily work that way, but in most cases, that is what I have found. And again, and looking at Natchitoches, Louisiana, in case you don't know Natchitoches, Louisiana, it is where Still Magnolias was filmed. And they still have those lights up, you know, along the Red River. In Natchitoches, Louisiana, there was a woman, Suzanne Matoya. She was a daughter of Pierre Matoya and Marie Teresa Corncorn. Some of you know Corncorn from in another connection. She maintained a long-lasting relationship with a Jean Baptiste auntie who was a European man. They had 5 children together. In the meanwhile, Suzanne Matoya developed a financial assets on her own. She was a terrific cotton planter, and at her death in 1838, her assets were worth $61,000, and she had real as well as personal property. When I was in Natchitoches, I did go to the clerk's office, and I found I found some papers dealing with her will, and I want to just put these on the overhead, not to read, but just to put it on here to show you where it is talking about her grandchildren are trying to get her resources. And here we began to get into the resources. They list the things that this woman owned, like looking glasses, beds, chairs, armoires, spinning wheels, bathtubs, kitchen utensils. And then after you go down through such a long list there, then you begin to see that she also owned slaves. And they list the slaves by name, and they talk about how much each slave is worth. This whole document was more than 10 pages because it was an inventory. And she did have some heirs, but she died without a will. And as it turned out, once everything went through the legal system, once all of her debts were paid, she left slightly more than $11,000 to 5 of her direct descendants, which is no small amount of money for that period of time. And you could go through that same family, as Gary Mills did do in his book, Forgotten People, and you see the same kinds of resources. And these are people who are interesting, and they're people who are very much unto their own, and they stay pretty much together. They also married within the family. Sometimes you'll find some first cousins who marry. Now, the Matoyas are exceptions. What about women who did not have the resources? To be sure, there were some women who were very, very poor. And I did look at the records in Philadelphia at the poor house, and I found a lot of women, black women, who went into the poor house. When they got there, they usually were so sick and so poor that they died in pretty record numbers. And when you compare the women at the poor house in Philadelphia, free black women with white women, the free black women had a high death rate in the poorhouse. And it suggests to me that once they went into the poorhouse, then they were they had used all of their resources. You had some clubs and organizations, but it suggests to me that they had depleted those resources and that they could not necessarily help themselves financially, and they had relatives and friends who could not necessarily help themselves. So I think I'm safe in saying the greater number of your poor free people are going to be in the North because they got their freedom en masse without special conditions, whereas in the South it's a very different kind of thing. Sometimes if women could not make a living in a legitimate way, then they turn to illegitimate ways or illegal ways. And looking at the convict docket in Philadelphia between 1838 and 1864, there were more than 1,000 women who went to jail, black as well as white, and the crime of choice was larceny. The crime of choice was larceny. And you have no difference between white women stealing and black women stealing. You have large numbers of them who are involved in the same kind of thing. But what is different And this is where the essence of who the person is comes in. What was different is how many months they were sentenced. You might have a white woman who was sentenced 3 months for stealing something that's worth $3. A black woman might be sentenced 1 year. So you have those disparities there. So there are many, many different kinds of things that you can look at, and the kind of study that I'm doing, it, as I see it, is a synthesis study. It covers a lot of ground, and I fully expect to receive a lot of criticism about trying to do so much in one book, but that's okay, because I know there are a lot of enterprise and graduate students who can come right along and do it state by state. And that's okay. You can do it state by state, you can do it city by city, and that will be fine. And if we do those kinds of things, then we'll have some answers to the questions. And finally, as I bring this to an end, I will make just a few remarks about, like, women entering the ministry. I'm working on revising a chapter now that deals with the spiritual autobiographies of several women, and I'm looking at 6 different spiritual women, and I'm having a very difficult time getting a handle on this, because I am arguing that their feminism comes out of their spirituality and comes out of religion. And I'm arguing this as opposed to some people looking at their feminism being seated in the abolitionist movement. But when I look at people like Jerana Lee, Julia A.J. Foote, and Zilpha Elaw, some of the things that they're saying make me think that they are looking out for the interests of women, and they don't always go far. Sometimes when they try to justify their calls to preach, they will go to the Bible, and they come up with scripture like, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither bond nor free, there is neither male nor female. And see, they take what they need and want, and they use it. Sometimes they ignore things to the contrary. That is very clear. And then there was a woman, Elizabeth, who was trying to justify her call to preach, and she opened the Bible, and she said it just fell open to the pages, and she looked down and she saw the scripture that said, gird up thy loins, now like a man, answer thy me, obey God rather than man. And these women were also very familiar with the book of Esther. And Sojourner Truth used the book of Esther on 2 levels. She used the book of Esther in looking at Vashti in not obeying the king and going on her own. And she also looks at Esther as being a woman who liberates a group of people. Sojourner Truth then used a substitute for Jews for African Americans and women's roles to help to liberate African Americans. Much has been said about the speech that Sojourner Truth is supposed to have given in 1851. And that speech, whether it was a real speech or whether it was a reconstructed speech, is one that will make the link for me between the religious women, because Sojourner Truth was a spiritualist. It'll make the link between the spiritualist and the abolitionist movement, and somehow their feminism is seated in there. So by the time I get all of this sorted out, I think I will be at the end of the book. I will be at the end of the book, and the only other thing left to do is talk about the roles of women in the abolitionist movement, and there's plenty that has been done on that. And at the very end of this paper, I say, regardless of the way that African American women were portrayed by mean-spirited whites, there's little to support the notion that they were uniformly self-centered, you know, and spending all of their money to buy fancy dresses and to fix their hair in particular ways. There's little uniform evidence to say that these women were truly self-centered, pretentious, conspicuous consumers, and that they were really about putting on airs. What I find in doing this work is that the action of many free women suggests that they were not content with their own freedom until they could see that others around them could enjoy the true essence of liberty. Thank you.
Before we start with questions, I know a number of you have other commitments, so if you would like to get up and leave without trooping over everybody, let's just take a minute to do that. Maybe you want to stand for a second, too. We've been seated for a little bit. I know the buzzword of the 90s is to be constantly challenged, and I think Dr. King has challenged herself greatly in this. Yeah, you can go ahead. Okay, I think the floor is open for questions. Okay, down and back in the middle.
Address anything that's dealing with the rural women. You have a book, for example, Ambiguous Lives deals with rural women. And beyond that, if any of these women were property holding women, and their records would be like at your courthouses and the like. So you can find material that deals with the property holding women. Aside from that, there is a collection of letters yet to be printed by the University of Georgia Press dealing with free women who live in the country in southern Mississippi. I guess some of you would think all of Mississippi is country, but there are few places that are not quite that way. And Pearl was not on the map when I grew up in Mississippi. Pearl is the name of the town that's in the news today. So there are sources that are available. At LSU, there's a collection of letters written by the Johnson women, and Johnson was a barber, and his wife remained in Natchez, and she did have some farms after he died, and she did run the farm. So there are sources that are available to do that. Unlike trying to do work on slaves, there's so much more that's available on free people. And the work that I did on slave children was always going through somebody else's work to find the children, simply because children didn't write for themselves and they didn't necessarily talk for themselves. And so there are sources that are available. Yes, Dr. Reed. I have Dr. Reed's book on my computer table.
Are you going to deal at all with black women entrepreneurs, free black women businesses? And I'll tell you why I raised that. You and I had some conversations about this stuff. And I found compelling information that I didn't pursue about women, black women who own businesses in Philadelphia, businesses like stores, what we would call today import-export businesses, caterers. Mm-hmm. The trail got cold pretty fast. Mm-hmm. Have you been able to get some heat in it?
Okay, there are some sources that, of course, are much better than others, and the greater number of women were laundresses, and this is a kind of business, but it's a small business. But where you have women who are more involved in kinds of things in the buying and selling are the women who are involved in the dressmaking. Okay, so, and there is a book that was written by Eliza Potter. It's called A Hairdresser's Experience in the High Life. And it's a wonderful book simply because she talks about being this hairdresser, but she also had been a seamstress. And if you want to know about how they made the dresses and what they really look like, then Eliza Potter tells you that. But going beyond that, this is a woman who would make $200 and $300 in a summer combing hair, and she does more than comb the hair of wealthier white women. She owns her own beauty school, so she teaches other people how to do that. So there are some materials that are available, but certainly they're uneven, and you can find more than you really maybe want to know about the Matoyas in Louisiana, because they're involved in the cotton business. They also trap bears for the grease, and they sell the grease, the fat from the animal fat for industrial to industrial companies and all of this kind of thing. So it's there, and you can find really a good bit on the women of in the Gulf ports, and that's because of the work that's been done by Virginia Gould in New Orleans, Pensacola, and Mobile. And then Kimberly Hanger has also done a good bit of work on New Orleans. So it's there, and it may not be as rich and as full as we would always want it, but I found lots of things on women who own boarding houses and who own catering businesses, and they have their own cook shops. Yeah. I see two hands. I see three hands. Anybody? Yes.
Could you repeat the author or the sources available for non-fiction like yours, but less?
Okay, it's by Karen Hansen, and it was in Gender and History like two summers ago.
Karen
Hansen. Yeah, I have it here. I don't see it right now, but oh, here it is. I can give it to you. It's by Karen Hansen. It's in Gender and History. So about two summers ago.
Okay, thank you.
Karen Hansen is at maybe Brandeis. And actually, I learned about her work because I had posted a message on the email about people doing work on free women, and her teaching assistant responded to it. And then I did write her and tell her how I had gotten the information about it, and she was kind enough to send me the unpublished version of her work. Dr. Hine.
First of all, let me tell you, this is a fabulous project. It's very, very exciting. And I was wondering if you had found some information or were you going to devote a chapter to the cultural work of black women during this period, mm-hmm. as part of
right, right. I have. There will be seven chapters. The first chapter looks at the origin. The second chapter looks at gender conventions. The third chapter probably has to do with work. And the fourth chapter looks at the cultural, looks at their writings. And I'll look at the poems, the books, the short stories of work, like people like Frances E.W. Harper. And then look at the club movement, because the clubs, the benevolent clubs, often had a literary arm to that. And then There's a bit of work available on, I think her name is Elizabeth Green, what Jackie, Greenfield, something I can't remember. And this is a woman who is trained as, she's a singer. So I will look at the cultural aspects of that in one of the chapters. Do you know of some things that I need to make sure that I include?
No, I think you covered everything.
No, I don't want to really miss anything, but I will take a look at the literature. And in the literature, we think a lot about Frances E.W. Harper because of the poems and all that she wrote, but there also are the novels, and I think it's Frances Smith who has recovered some of those novels that were serialized. And one of those novels deals with Reconstruction. And it's a good way of looking at how a writer dealt with Reconstruction. So, and then I'll deal with the short stories that she wrote also.
Well, one of the reasons why I asked the question is because when we think of black women's history, a lot of us think in terms of the interior lives that black women had to develop and cultivate in order to survive the oppression and the exploitation, that there had to be something set apart from what is very visible and very apparent to most people, and that it's in their cultural productions, their status, that they really show what they're, how they're feeling, what they're thinking, and how they manage to carve out a living space for themselves. That's the context.
Right, and there are some pieces of art that are available to take a look at, like the work by Douglas, the bunch of flowers that were here, and then there are some others that I have seen photographs of. I saw another hand. Ms. Lagler, yes.
Yes, thank you. Actually, this is sort of related to what Dr. Hine was asking. I if memory serves me correctly, some of the scholars working on free women in the Gulfport states are also looking at gender consciousness. And I know you said you were going to look at gender conventions. I'm wondering if you're going to do anything with gender consciousness, and if so, if you're finding any indication of regional variety within gender consciousness.
No, I haven't found any. See, I'm at a stage now where I am revising some chapters, and then when I go back through it the next time, that'll be the third time going back through it, then that's when I want to do some more things with gender and then look at some kinds of theories and see how these are applicable to some of the kinds of things that women were facing. And I right now, I haven't really found so much that talks about gender and seeing differences across regions. And it could be that I just haven't looked intensely enough for it. But maybe I could use some help.
Yeah.
Ms. Stolman?
It's actually a converse to Amy's question. You mentioned about reinforcement of the social distance between free women and the enslaved women.
Mm-hmm.
Could you comment on that and how they do that within the urban setting?
Okay, in the urban setting, it's going to be much more difficult than it is in a rural setting, because the urban setting is much more fluid. In a place like New Orleans, which is really an exception, you may not find you might not find that aloofness there. But if you move into other areas, especially where laws are tightening up after 1831, then you might see that kind of thing happening. I think New Orleans is not a good example for that, because it's so fluid. And you have so many people who are passing for free, who are slaves. You have so many people who are also passing for white, who are actually people of color. So that's more difficult. And then, you know, the more I look at this, I'm wondering if Berlin were not a bit outdated. And in my class earlier today, we looked at the publication date on Ira Berlin's book, which was somewhere in the 1970s. And we also looked at Michael Johnson's Black Masters, which sort of supports the same thing. But both of those books were published before Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl became so very popular. Mm-hmm. And I sort of believe that if you can find it in one, you're going to find these kinds of things somewhere else. And there's a lot of work that's being done, you know, all the time about looking at free women and all, and, you know, the relationships that they have. And one of the books that really looks at the relationship between free women and slave women is Victoria Bynum, but she only does the three counties in Unruly Women. Ms. McLeod, and then I don't know your name yet. Yes.
Do you deal with marriage patterns?
Okay, I haven't really done anything specifically with marriage patterns. I've come across different materials that's talking about women being married. And some years ago, Suzanne Lipsock argued that free black women did not marry because they wanted to protect their property. And if they married, then the property would become the property of their husbands. And then more recently, Michael Johnson argued that free black women probably would find more comfort in marriage. I have found some examples to show that these women are very much interested in marrying, whether they have property or not. And I also have found just a few examples where some of these women are very much like Vashti. You know, they believe that a man is the head of the household, but they don't believe that they should follow a man who's misguided. I mean, and they say that, you know, you don't get any credit for following him if he's wrong. So, and I do think that it's a tremendous amount of work that I am trying to do, and there'll be a lot of questions that are coming up. But I also know that you'll never cover it all. You'll never cover it all. And, you know, if I don't get it right this time, then I'll do it in the second edition. Did you have, yes. I saw your hand there.
Yes, a question. Being from Mississippi and having graduated from Historical Black University in Mississippi.
Who, you or me?
Well, myself.
I did too.
Okay. I've seen firsthand, you know, the prejudices of some Creoles towards Creole women, towards dark-skinned African-American women. And in your research of the Creoles of 1860 in parts of Louisiana, have you found that the sense of those Creoles, do they have the same mindset?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know about today. I don't like to make those tremendous stretches like that. But in terms of the way they behave then, here are a group of people who see themselves as special. And they see themselves as special in many instances because they do have some property. And one of the ways of holding on to that property is to marry people who are very much like themselves. And so you'll often see people who are marrying into families where there are resources. And you see this going on especially among the Creoles. And those that I looked at in Louisiana, they are, some of them, in order to keep these things within their own circle, they do marry relatives who are very close. And this is not a traditional kind of thing within the African American community. And in terms of how they are perceived by others, I haven't necessarily seen that. But when I was in Natchitoches, I did meet a man who was a descendant of Marie Matoya, you know, like the person who starts out in the 1700s with this family of new people in the Cane River. And he seemed to have been, you know, he was very, very pleased and very proud of his ancestry. And we get to a situation where people have to come to grips with actually who they are, because you have these people who are part European and they're part African. And it's like the poem Cross by Langston Hughes. You know, if I ever curse my old mother because she's black, then I take my curses back. And then talked about the white father. So they have to come to grips with who they are, and they do see themselves as special people, and they are people who have some. They're different from some others. Sometimes they see themselves as better than black people, and you know they're looking at who they are, and it's sort of like. I guess Tiger Woods is a very good example. Even with his logo, he has on the top of his logo, it's like a golf ball, and it has like a map of the world. But the way this map is turned, you see Asia there, and he's paying some respect to his mother who is Asian, and he also has to pay some respect to his father. So as I see it, you know, the Creoles, they can't say they're black because they aren't black. You know, it's a social construction in the sense that in this country they said if you have a drop of black blood, then you are black. But how is it that they grew up? Who did they grow? How is it that they grew up? Who did they grow up with? You know, so they have to come to terms with who they are, and they see themselves as a people who are special. And I guess they have a right to see themselves in that way. You can't shape and make all people the same thing. More recently, there's been a lot of work done on the social construction of race. Yes. I talk about spirituality and what else?
Well, I wanted to know, so far you based your spirituality on biblical scripture, right?
Okay, yes. What I'm doing, I'm looking at a number of women who wrote spiritual narratives, and I'm not looking at other kinds of things. It's just six women there. Religion is always one of the more difficult chapters for me. I think it becomes so difficult because I want to get it right, and I don't want to offend anybody. And I'm always so conscious of what I really don't know with this. So it's a very difficult chapter for me. But what I want to do with religion and with this spirituality, you have these women who are called to preach. They want to preach. They have to justify their right to preach. And they will go to the Bible to pull out the scripture that will say that. Now, they don't go beyond the scriptures that will tell them that they have a right to preach and talking about other kinds of things, how it would impact upon women.
And I'm only looking at the spirituality in that way. So is it something else I should do? Ms. Robinson has a degree from Princeton School of Divinity or something like that. So she keeps me on my toes here. Okay, but that's where I am with the religion part, and it's not easy for me. I will have a small amount of discussion about a Catholic woman, Henriette DeLille, who is now being considered for canonization, and she was a founder of the Sisters of the Holy Family.
Yeah. More questions? Peter.
Do you find much evidence for free women left America, particularly in economic America, left the country, let's say, possibly England?
I don't find very much at all on free people who left the country. There was the American Colonization Society, and in many cases, they simply did not wish to separate themselves from their relatives and friends, living and dead in America. And you do have some people who will go to Liberia, and they go in rather small numbers, and it's because of not wanting the disengagement from family and friends, and then there are also some other kinds of things there. In those letters that were edited by Randall Miller, Dear Master, there's a section that's dealing with people who went to Liberia, and when they write back, they talk about how much they miss their friends and how much they miss their family. So you don't have large numbers of them who will go. You have some who will go to Haiti, but you also have some of that same group who will come back. And what they do in many instances, if they're going to go somewhere and they want to be outside of the United States because slavery is legal and they are fearful, they will go to Canada, which is easier. And you have some places in Canada now, you know, that's very much a part of what was happening then. So that's what I find. But you find that free people as well as slaves were very much aware of the Haitian Revolution. And that was an impact upon this country.
One more question? No more questions?
Could you just comment a little bit more on the artist or the caricatures that you where was circulated?
Okay, one of the artists was David Claypool Johnston, and you can find some of these same caricatures in Gary Nash's book, Forging Freedom. There is a dissertation that has been completed on the subject, and there is a book in the MSU library. It's an oversized book in the art department, in the art library, on these same things, but I can't remember the name of it. They were popular in the United States, and they also were popular outside of the United States, and they were purchased. You could purchase them in sets. And they're actually very beautiful watercolors. I'm not talking about the subject. I'm talking about, you know, just the way they look when you see the originals. And the originals are at the Library Company of Philadelphia. There's a small book called Abolitionist Sisterhood that has a chapter in it, and it deals with some of these.
Thank you very much, Dr. King, for your...
Well, thank you.
And thank you for your attendance and participation. Have a good evening.
That's a big crowd.
Yeah.